Thessalonians 5 is where we're going to be picking up our study tonight, so you can be turning there. We looked at the first half of the chapter on Sunday, so we're going to pick up in verse 12 tonight and try to get through the end of the chapter. If we don't, we can clean up a few things from that on this coming Sunday. We've got an extra class period or two built into the quarter that in case we have some delays like that. I want especially to focus on verses 12 through 22 tonight. I'll talk about that in just a minute. Sometimes in Paul's letters, near the conclusion, there will be kind of a series of general exhortations. And in this case, unlike the previous section, remember Paul started in the middle of chapter 4 talking about the day of the Lord, talking about the Thessalonians, or were evidently the Thessalonians' concerns about that, about what was going to become of their brothers and sisters who had already died, when that was going to happen, and those kinds of things. He's addressed that since chapter 4, verse 13. But these instructions here are not, it seems, not aimed so much at specific problems at Thessalonica. We'll talk about a couple of possibilities there, but just at the broader life of believers. Romans 12 has a section that's kind of like this, where there's a lot of very brief exhortations about a number of different things in that chapter. So what we're going to do is look primarily at verses 12 through 22, and then time permitting, we'll look at the very last several verses of this First Thessalonian letter. Reading starting in verse 12. But we request of you, brethren, that you appreciate those who diligently labor among you and have charge over you in the Lord and give you instruction, and that you esteem them very highly in love because of their work. Live in peace with one another. We urge you, brethren, admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with everyone. See that no one repays another with evil for evil, but always seek after that which is good for one another and for all people. Rejoice always. Pray without ceasing. In everything give thanks, for this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus. Do not quench the Spirit. Do not despise prophetic utterances, but examine everything carefully. Hold fast to that which is good. Abstain from every form of evil. Don Truex has called this 60 Seconds to a Healthy Church because it takes about a minute to read it. And it's got all of these different terse kinds of expressions in it that cover a lot of ground in the life of individual Christians and in our life together. Remember that this is Paul's how Paul starts to wind to a conclusion this first letter that he writes to this congregation at Thessalonica. Remember, how long have any of these people at Thessalonica been Christians? Yeah, just a very short time. A few months at the most. And remember, Paul labored at Thessalonica for a brief time. We don't know exactly how long, but his time there is kind of cut short by opposition that forced him to leave town. And we've talked about that a couple of times in connection with our studies in this letter. And he's giving them some brief exhortations here at the end. Probably not things that they're completely unaware of, seeing as how they're dealt with in such brief fashion. But very important reminders, again, for their lives individually as disciples, and for their life together as a church. So we're going to go work our way through this text and just talk about that a little bit. First of all, in verse 12, what does Paul say? Back up. In verse 12, who are those? He talks about those who labor among you and are over in the Lord and admonish you. Who is he talking about? And And why would you say that? I heard somebody say elders. Okay. Okay, all right. Okay. So those who are in leadership roles, which we, Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 17, it talks about those who obey those who rule over you. You probably noticed that in 1 Thessalonians, Paul doesn't actually use the familiar terms like elders or overseers or pastors, bishops, however they might be translated. But he does talk about those who are in leadership positions, and of course that those are the terms that are applied to the men who possess the gifts for that, the qualifications for that role, and have been appointed to that role. What does he say the Thessalonians need to do toward those people, those men? Okay. All right. We request of you that you appreciate them in some of our translations, or recognize them. The word basically means to know somebody, but it has a sense of acknowledging or recognizing someone here. I mean, what is it that needs to be recognized about them?
Well, they have great responsibility.
Okay, all right. Again, we could go to Hebrews 13 and see a little summary of that. They watch out for your souls. He says in Hebrews 13, let them do this with joy and not with grief, for this would be unprofitable for you. He could just as easily say that here, okay? Somebody else? Appreciate them, a recognition of the vital work that they do, and do you think that implies cooperation with them and submission to their leadership? Okay. Can I appreciate them and recognize them the way Paul says, if I won't follow their leading, that doesn't quite work, does it?
Yes, he says esteem them very highly.
Esteem them very highly. That's the kind of the next phrase. Esteem them very highly in love because of their work. Again, to esteem has a sense of regarding or counting. It's to esteem. It's the word Paul uses in Philippians 2 and verse 3 when he says, let each of you esteem others as better than himself. It's regard for someone. Esteem them very highly, which I understand in Greek is kind of an exceptional superlative that Paul uses there, kind of an unusual expression. This is really, really highly, beyond measure. Because of their work. In fact, that word's only used here in the New Testament text. Those who diligently labor among you. By the way, that's an expression. Anybody got the New International Version? No, nobody's got the. David's not here tonight. I can always count on him to have the NIV. He's not here. Okay, what you got? What you got, Mike?
In verse 13.
Yeah. Okay. What about verse 12?
Now we ask you, brothers and sisters, to acknowledge those who work hard among you, who care for you in the Lord and admonish you.
Okay. Those who work hard among you. Yeah, that's the sense of Paul's word. Diligently labor sounds fancier, but it is work to the point of being tired that's really conveyed by this term. And they have charge over you. They are in a leadership role, and that having charge over you also, again, should call to mind Hebrews chapter 13. They keep watch over your souls. It's not just that they're in charge. It's that they have a responsibility toward the souls of the people over whom they are exercising that authority. Why is this important? Sometimes commentators can't avoid speculating, why does Paul choose to highlight these particular things in his parting lines to the Thessalonians? Is it because there was some particular problem with that at Thessalonica? Was some danger concerning that? And there's nothing in the text that really tells us that. But why would this be so important for a young church undergoing persecution like the Thessalonians? Shane, go ahead.
They probably weren't instructed completely
So the encouragement and the idea of getting things off to a good start, would be vital and important that they, what was going on at that time.
Yeah, very, very good. I mean, Ryan?
I mean, it's consistently a danger that you just take for granted those people who are doing work and who are, who are leading or trying to lead, and just to take for granted that the efforts that they put in. But I think when things are going well, it's easy to follow. When things are going difficult, everyone has an idea about what should be done and what's the best way to do it. But there are people with experience and wisdom who we need to listen to, and it's easy to kind of push that aside when things are difficult.
Okay, yeah, good point. And yet it's more important that when it's difficult, it's more important than ever that that not be put aside. Yeah, very good. Mike?
I think to Ryan's point, sometimes when there's difficulty, the role between leadership and those who lead can become an us versus them mentality. And that's the opposite of what he wants. He says, be at peace among yourselves. This is a symbiotic relationship where the leaders are leading for the good of the people and they're following for their own good. And verse 11, which we covered last time, he's talking about encouraging one another. Mm-hmm.
And I'll second that. That's been my observation as well. Remember, we said when we closed Wednesday night, we said that it's easy to see these instructions as fleshing out some of the things that Paul talked about in the earlier part of the chapter, when he talked about because of the uncertainty of the time of Christ's return. It could be tomorrow. Could be delayed for centuries. We just don't know. And, in light of both of those being real possibilities, the only thing to do is to always be prepared. And so Paul calls the Thessalonians, calls all of us to diligent discipleship. And what he starts to lay out in verse 12, well, really beginning verse 11, I guess, is what that looks like. Just, not everything, but some examples of what that should look like, and particularly needful ones for the congregation at Thessalonica. And been some good observations already about how that here's this congregation in a very difficult set of circumstances. Every congregation needs good leadership, but especially one in the circumstances that Thessalonica faces. And if they've got it, they need to follow it. Okay, Shane? Yeah, absolutely. The last expression in verse 13 makes a nice bridge to what follows: live in peace with one another. And then Paul's going to talk about some specific needs, people in certain situations or with certain needs, and how we are to respond to those. He says, "We urge you, brethren, admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with everyone." By the way, you guys that preach, there are so many great built-in sermon outlines in this text from verse 12 down to verse 21. Verse 14 is a great four-point sermon all by itself. There's lots of that here. Just a little hint there thrown in for free. So Paul talks about four categories of person. And I'll just say, these first three, because the fourth one is all, these first three are circumstances where any Christian might find themselves in this situation at some point in their walk with God. We'll talk more about that in a minute. We urge you, brethren, admonish the unruly. Does anybody have a different word besides unruly or disorderly in verse 14? Anybody got something else?
Idle.
Okay. I want to come back to that because you may think, well, wait a minute, that's really different than unruly or disorderly. We're going to talk about why some of our translations have chosen to put idle there. The word that's translated unruly means disorderly, and some of our translations have that. It means out of ranks, like a soldier who's out of line, deviating from the prescribed order or rule. This is somebody who is walking in a way that is not right. It described a soldier who was insubordinate. It described a laborer who neglected at his work. People use this word, you know, those kind of circumstances, in non-biblical contexts all the time. But for Paul, this is someone who's spiritually disorderly. He's not following the rules. And let's just remember, what are the rules? The commandments of God. He's not walking in keeping with that. He knows what he ought to do, it seems, but for one reason or another, is not doing that. Now, some translations have the word idle here because in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, we haven't gotten to that yet, we will in a few class periods. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, Paul will use some of the same words or very closely kin words that he uses in this part of verse 14, over in 2 Thessalonians 3, starting in verse 6, where he is talking about folks at Thessalonica who were living a disorderly life. That's what he says. They were living an undisciplined life, uses the same word there, and specifically they were not doing any work. They were making busybodies of themselves, minding everybody's business but their own. That seems to have been perhaps in response to the misconceptions that some of the Thessalonians had about the return of the Lord. We talked about that a little bit Sunday. But because that's the application of disorderly in 2 Thessalonians 3, a lot of commentators, a lot of interpreters, and even some of the publishers of English translations have concluded that's probably the folks that Paul specifically is targeting in 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 14. But just understand, the word that he uses here really has a broader meaning than idleness. Idleness would be a form of disorderliness or unruliness, but not the only possible one. Just for sake of our conversation, let's just take it in the broadest sense of somebody they're out of line. What does Paul say I need to do with that person? What does he say we need to do with that person? All right, admonish them. What does admonish mean? Yeah, okay. It's the same word that Paul used back in verse 12. Those who labor among you and have charge over you and give you instruction or admonish you. But here it has not just the sense of instruction, but the specific sense of instruction with a view toward correcting somebody's behavior. Warn is what some of our translations have. You tell them something needs to change. You try to correct them. We work to persuade that person to do better. That may require, again, these are very general, brief kinds of statements. That correction may require a gentle reminder. It may require stronger words of rebuke. What is it we're trying to do? Trying to get to that person to change his conduct so it's not disorderly anymore. It's orderly. Is ruly a word? Unruly is a word. You get the picture. The second phrase in this or clause in this this verse, encourage the faint-hearted. Who are the faint-hearted? If your translation has a different word, let me hear it, and let's talk about what Paul's describing here. Okay, all right. I think a couple of our translations actually say discouraged. And that's, you know, that's kind of the idea. The word literally is small-souled, but I think timid is what one or two of our translations have there. But it's descriptive of a person who is easily discouraged, or who may be in the situation where they are discouraged. What might that be like? Maybe it's a person who is overly sensitive to criticism. Or in the case of the Thessalonians, somebody who has really, you know, felt the harshness of opposition or persecution because of his faith, and it's caused him to be discouraged. Maybe it's somebody who easily loses heart when he makes a mistake. You know, sometimes, and this is true in every arena of life, and it's definitely true spiritually. Sometimes people make mistakes, and they are able to own up to those mistakes, learn from them, and move on pretty easily. Other people, they own up to the mistake, they learn from it, but it devastates them. And depending on the nature of the error and the consequences of it, we should be able maybe to understand that. Maybe that's the kind of person that this might describe. Or somebody who's just fearful of opposition, but somebody who's discouraged by the failures of others. Sometimes it's not our failures, it's the ones we see in other people that discourage us. There are all kinds of things that could contribute to a person being, in Paul's words, small-souled, or timid, or discouraged. This person needs help because if they're not helped, what could very well happen? Okay. Yeah. You know, a person could become discouraged enough that they give up, that they stop having confidence in God's grace toward them, for instance, or in the love of their brothers and sisters even, or God's love toward them. That happens sometimes. So what does Paul say to do for that person? Okay. He says, encourage them, or comfort them, some of our translations have. This is the kind of word that you would use to, you know, of comforting somebody who was grieving, even, or of trying to encourage somebody who was in a circumstance of great sadness or despair. That's what you're trying to do for them. Maybe that person needs a cheerful word. Maybe that person just needs somebody to talk to. They need a sympathetic ear. They need to know that they're not alone. Yeah, Carrie, go ahead. Right. Excellent. I was raised. And you lead me to something. All right. Do we all, let's be honest, are we all unruly from time to time in terms of not doing what we, sure. Okay. All right. I think Paul has especially in mind a person who is openly unruly, but we've all been there. Do we all get discouraged from time to time? Sure. Eric, go ahead.
To the point that you're making right there, we as the body of Christ, the Christians, we need to understand that we have a responsibility to be quiet, like the Lord tells us in the Bible, be quiet and listen to His word, follow His word. We need to be quiet and listen to the elders. And to the lead, just like back to the other point in leadership, you know, make sure the leadership is strong, but just be quiet, listen to them. Sometimes we can get to the point where we want to be the leader. Too many chiefs. Mm-hmm. And be quiet. Let them lead, and then that faint hearted person may get faint hearted because they see all the chaos. Mm-hmm. What's going on? You know, why are they challenging the leadership? You know, just be quiet and encourage one another and let them help you to lead.
Yeah, that's another good example of the kind of thing that can cause discouragement. Yeah, very good. Shane?
Well, when you think about the context of what you're dealing with, you've got a very young congregation, there's persecution going on. So what's the first thing you
sinning, causing, you know, disruptions. They're gonna affect the cohesivity of the congregation. If you've got people that are frightened and discouraged because of the persecution, oh, what are we gonna do? Oh, we're just gonna die, and that can spread. You need to encourage those people so that doesn't go on. We, you know, I'm gonna give up because this is too much. I didn't sign up for this. You know, all this persecution stuff. All of these things can tear a congregation apart. And so Paul is tying all of this up, you know, neatly in order of, you know, these are the things that you need to be doing to make sure that you guys remain strong.
Very good. Let's talk about this third group. The weak, those without strength. Who's he talking about? I don't know. How many ways are there to say something? Somebody's weak, right?
Could be weak faith.
Okay.
Could be people with physical illness.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, this is a word that can technically apply to somebody who's got physical ailments. I don't think that's what Paul has in mind. Just given the context, but you know the word can apply to that. But just think of the New Testament teaching that reminds us somebody can be weak in faith, somebody can be weak in their level of commitment, somebody can be weak in conscience with regard to certain things. 1 Corinthians 8 through 10, Romans 14 deal with those kinds of things. You know, weak with regard to, you know, to their sense of duty or responsibility. There's a lot of different ways that this might manifest itself, just like discouragement, just like unruliness can manifest themselves in a lot of different ways. You know, picture a Christian who is a student, a young student, and is experiencing some doubts about their faith. We talked about doubt Sunday night, okay? And you know, gave us some really good reminders about dealing with that. Maybe it's a new convert who still has a lot to learn. Hello, Thessalonians. They all were in that situation. They were all new converts as far as that goes. Again, maybe it's a brother or sister who's weak in conscience with regard to some matter that, as far as morals is concerned, is a matter of indifference. But as far as influence, or again, those Romans 14 kind of things, you know, may be pretty significant, and can have some significant impacts on people. Maybe they just lack the depth of knowledge and conviction that they need to have. What does Paul say we do with this person? We abandon them, right? They're dead weight. We don't need them. Now, what does he say? Okay. He says, uphold them. Support them. The word can mean either to endure or withstand, or it can mean to cling to or pay attention to. And so we are, we're putting up with their weaknesses while we try to build up what is lacking on their part. Both senses of that word, you know, can apply well to this person. And again, Romans 14 talks, and on into chapter 15, Paul talks about that, about we who are strong bearing with the infirmities of the weak. Because, you know, when you look at a context like Romans 14, you've got to concede sometimes the weaknesses of the weak, I don't want to say annoying, that's not the right word to use. But they were to some of the Christians at Rome. And to some of the Christians at Corinth. There's a lack of understanding, a lack of patience and compassion that might need to be overcome. Have we all been weak at some point? Here is why this verse is so important, because every disciple at some point is going to find himself or herself in one of these situations. It's going to happen. Probably, if you live long enough as a Christian, you're going to find yourself in all three of these situations at some point. And notice that now that Paul... Oh, we got one more, then I want to make that point. What does he say to do toward all? Be patient. Okay? This is that word that is often translated long suffering. It you know it has to do it literally means something like long tempered, and it has to do with patience and mildness even in the face of adversity or provocation. Most of the time, it has to do with patience with people who try our patience. It's usually the context in which that word's appearing. Warning the unruly, encouraging the faint-hearted, and upholding the weak is work. It can put a strain on us. If we are actually trying to do, I'm just talking individually for a minute, we're actually, as part of a congregation, trying to do the things Paul says in this verse. Warn the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, uphold the weak. We're looking around and seeing people that we know and love who are having various struggles. And we are trying to help them. And all of a sudden we realize if we're trying to do that, that starts to eat into our time and our energy and our our emotional energy, maybe our resources. And we can become impatient with that. It also requires patience because it may not always be easy at first to determine when somebody's struggling which one of these categories I should put them into. And I don't think Paul means for us to pigeonhole people, check them little box and he's unruly, but he's him. Is a person walking in a way that's willfully disorderly, or is there just a lack of understanding that they have to overcome? That they just not know yet? Is this person discouraged or weak? You see what I mean? And it takes patience in the sense of being willing to let things unfold, time patience, in order to sort that out sometimes. Well, here's the larger point I wanted to make about this verse. And Eric, what you said kind of made me think of it. Paul has just talked about our responsibility toward those who lead us, our responsibility to recognize them, to encourage them, and all of those to esteem them very highly in love. And that includes, I like the way you said it, be quiet and listen to them, follow their leading. But in verse 14, who does he lay the responsibility on? Everybody. He does not say in verse 14, leave this up to the leadership. Now they're going to lead the way in doing these things, but these are responsibilities we all have toward one another. This is yet, not to bang that drum too much, this is yet another one of those verses that highlights that Christian discipleship is not a solo act. We are in it together, and it involves, by definition, mutual responsibilities to one another that we fulfill toward one another in this setting we call a local church. Paul's just highlighting a few of those as he talks to the Thessalonians. Shane did a really good job a minute ago of this is why this is so important for a church that's got a lot working against it. Because if these things are just allowed to go on without being addressed, they could at least, at the very least, be very damaging to some individual spiritual lives. They could be damaging to the fabric of the whole church. And Paul, unlike some contexts in, say, 1 Corinthians or other places, Paul doesn't present this as, hey, you're facing this existential threat to the well-being of the church, and here's what you need to do about it. He just says, do these things. We urge you, brethren, to do these, and just we request of you, follow your leaders, verse 12. We urge you, verse 14, admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, uphold the weak, be patient with all. Any other thoughts? Go ahead, Mark.
It seems like a natural place to reflect on Zoom. And what a blessing it is when we can't be together, but all of this that seems much harder not seeing each other regularly and interacting regularly. So
yeah,
we don't want to just kind of fall into the comfort zone of being by ourselves, of watching on a screen instead of being with fellow Christians.
Excellent point. Let me ask y'all something. You know, most of you have been part of this congregation, or at least been with us, you know, since the whole pandemic thing started 2 years ago. Especially in those initial days, you know, when we weren't able to meet for 10 weeks, and when there were a lot of fears and, you know, and if not flat out restrictions and recommendations that very much limited our interaction with one another, not just coming here, but people interacting with one another in generally. Did you suddenly, you know, find it, say, wait a minute, Paul's, you know, you think, maybe think about a verse like 1 Thessalonians 5:14. Wow, this is really making it hard to do that. Because I'm not seeing these people as much as I'm used to. That was a real challenge. But I tell you, one thing I noticed is that people got innovative. I said, well, we may not be able to see each other, but we've got phones and we've got computers and we've got other ways to, you know, to interact. And we can, you know, take needful precautions and see one another until this gets better. Because, and they did that because, okay, we don't stop being a church just because we're facing some difficult circumstances. And what we faced is nothing like what the Thessalonians were dealing with. And Paul said, you're still a church. You have these obligations to one another. Great, great point, Mark. And very, you know, very good observation. There's so much of this that requires not just our in-person participation in assemblies, as vital as that is, but our involvement in one another's lives. We live in a culture where we kind of don't like that. We want to, you know, we want to live and let live and be left alone. And Paul doesn't, you know, the New Testament, you know, says Christians are a family. Ryan, I didn't mean to overlook you. Go ahead.
The same idea about it, this section with 12 and 13 is counter to a lot of our culture. I would guess there were people back then who wanted to be left alone most of the time too. That was harder maybe, but the elder or those that watch over you, you know, in culture often people assert dominance, not serve. And so it's easy to kind of see and acknowledge those who are asserting dominance. I'm under them. But when they're serving, it's easier to overlook that. The church is in this group of fine-tuned super Christians who, if you can't get in with the, you know, if you can't do this without being unruly or weak, we don't have time for you. That's not what the church is about. We're about serving other people and helping everyone. And so he's got to remind them, this isn't like, well, sorry you couldn't cut it. Well, our losses and move on. You need to encourage and help those people. And unfortunately, many cultures, I think, back then and today, have a business or an organization. And if you can't hack it, we just need to let you go and we'll go in another direction. But that's not how the church is.
Sure. Yeah. Great point. You know, in a passage like 1 Corinthians 5, Paul, you know, teaches us, and he'll teach this in 2 Thessalonians 3 too. A person's disorderliness can reach a point, if they persist in it unrepentant, it can reach a point where their presence as part of the group becomes a threat to the group, and that needs to be dealt with. But you don't assume that from the start when there's a problem. It can be very easy to want to do that, right? You know, because that's the way it is in so many other, so many other things that we're used to. Verse 15, see that no one repays another evil for evil, but always seek after that which is good for one another and for all people. Let me give you a commentary on that from the same guy who wrote this, from Paul, Romans chapter 12. Romans 12, verse 17, never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Almost the same words. Respect what is right in the sight of all men. If possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. But if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink. In so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. It's almost like Paul thought that more congregations than just the Thessalonians needed this teaching. He thought the Romans needed it too. God thought the Romans needed it. This is universal.
Sure.
Other thoughts before we move on? Mike.
Just real quick. Patience isn't doing nothing. He put patience at the end. Patience looks like admonishing and comforting and helping and letting those things have time to do their work. It's not just sitting back and saying, well, it's probably the way.
Excellent. Yes. Yeah. Very good. One more.
This is just the opposite of the Old Testament teaching that I've learned.
Well, it is and it isn't. In Matthew chapter 5, Jesus addressed that. And the problem was the eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, you know, was I wish we had more time to talk about that. But it was a way of meting out punishment in the Jewish legal system that was neither too severe nor not severe enough. You know, the punishment was always in keeping with the crime. I mean that's not only eminently practical, it's very, you know, it's just, it's fair, it appeals to our sense of fairness. The problem was, I think Jesus is addressing in Matthew 5, is that people just took that as a license for personal vengeance. You know, you do something bad to me, then I have the right to do something bad back to you. And the problem with personal vengeance is we love to escalate things. It always ends up being out of proportion to the wrong we're trying to avenge. So Jesus teaches us, don't take your own revenge. And that's exactly what Paul was saying here. Okay. Well, we're about out of time. I have a few more things in this part of the chapter that we want to cover, and we'll kind of review 1 Thessalonians 5 a little bit, or 1 Thessalonians, the letter, a little bit. So we're going to do that Sunday morning. We're going to finish up chapter 5, look back on this letter just a little bit, and the next Wednesday night we'll start in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. So thanks, great comments tonight. Thanks so much for all your help this evening.